Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
This first story that I want to discuss with you falls into the category of practicing medicine without a license, which is becoming more and more the crime that American health insurance companies are committing without anyone slapping their hands or fining them or suing them or anything, and it's getting to be crazy. This comes from an editorial in a journal that I get called Practical Pain Management. It's sent out to primary care doctors, and also a few pain specialists get it as well. And in this case, the person writing the editorial wanted to talk about the overreaction to the so-called opiate crisis, which I would classify not as fake news, but as old news, and also, by the way, deaths from opiate overdose have been dropping since about 2012, but you don't hear that in the news. Anyway, he was talking about a new policy that insurance companies have. About 6 months ago, the CDC came up with a policy. They recommended a maximum dose of 90 morphine equivalent doses, morphine equivalents per day for patients. So that's, depending on what drug you're talking about, that might be anywhere from 25 milligrams to 150 milligrams, and everything is pegged to its morphine equivalent so that you can compare apples to apples. Now, this standard, it was not written as a ceiling. It was a recommendation, a guideline, and it said that you could go above this level. This isn't a maximum safe dosage, but it said that the benefits and harms should be evaluated within 1 to 4 weeks of a dose escalation. In other words, if you change the dose, see the person back within a month and see if you've gotten what you need. The insurance companies took that and ran with it. This particular company, who shall remain unnamed, decided that every patient receiving over 90 morphine equivalents was immediately going to have their dose cut in half and within 2 weeks dropped by another 25%. Now, this is regardless of whether the person has acute pain situation or chronic pain. It is appropriate, I might add, if you break your leg, that the first couple of weeks you might need high doses of opiates, and then 3 to 4 weeks out, yeah, it should be being tapered. That's absolutely true. But for chronic pain, particularly people who've been on opiates for many years at stable or even at slowly accelerating doses, this makes no sense. He goes on to talk about a condition, a fairly rare condition, a type of stroke. This is called a Dejerine-Roussy stroke, and it's a stroke in the part of the brain that feels pain. I have one such patient, and when you have this type of stroke, you sense any normal sensation, a light stroke of a finger on that side of your body, will go through your brain and be interpreted as if someone had taken a razor blade and run it across your skin. This is obviously a very, very difficult situation to treat. And when you finally find a treatment that's working for a person with a syndrome like that, you just don't want to mess with it. And messing with the practice of medicine is exactly what's going on. The insurance companies are using the, again, hear the air quotes, opiate crisis as an excuse to reduce benefits to patients. I have a couple of consumer alerts that I've sprinkled throughout the program to keep your attention, and the first of those is right now. Your risk of acute heart failure triples if you have atrial fibrillation and go on proton pump inhibitors. Now, regular listeners to my program have heard many times my raising the alarm and caution bell about using Prilosec or Lantoprazole, Omeprazole, any of these drugs every day for long periods of time. We know these drugs reduce stomach acid. That's what they're for. But the problem is, you need stomach acid. You need it to absorb iron. You need it to absorb calcium. And you need it to absorb B12. So as a result, we see more dementia, more osteoporosis, more neuropathy, and more anemia in people who are taking proton pump inhibitors. If you've got heartburn, you shouldn't be using proton pump inhibitors. You should be using a completely different program where you actually increase your stomach acid with meals. You can do that very simply, even just drinking some apple cider vinegar or taking some hydrochloric acid tablets or capsules will help that reflux. Eating less and unloosening your belt when you eat, not lying down for 2 hours after eating, these are also important, simple lifestyle measures that you can take. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't use proton pump inhibitors to treat an ulcer, but I am saying that you shouldn't be on these drugs for years and years and years without being carefully monitored for all of these adverse side effects. This is a new adverse side effect, and it's a big one. 3 times greater chance of hospitalization for acute heart failure if you have atrial fibrillation and use these drugs long term. It's thought to be due to the anemia that is generated in these cases. In any event, just wanted to put that consumer watch out there. To something a little meatier, and not meat and potatoes exactly, but certainly biological. And we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics, the human microbiome. So I'm sharing with you a review of the evidence for the use of probiotics in gastrointestinal conditions, conditions that you might suffer from every day. As you may know, we have in our intestines lots of bacteria, and these bacteria have some very interesting properties, among which they are regulatory. They actually help your bowel movements be regular, not too... It's a Goldilocks phenomenon, isn't it? You don't want too many, and you don't want too few. You want it just right. And in the case of infectious diarrhea, there are so many studies showing that probiotics reduce the duration of diarrhea in children. And we're talking like a full day. This is not a trivial, non-clinically meaningful reduction. If you've had to stay home from work because your baby has diarrhea, that's some serious financial impact potentially. They won't take that child in daycare until that diarrhea is gone. And if you can make it gone in 25 fewer hours, that makes a big difference for any family. And this is true for adults as well. If you start probiotics immediately upon the development of diarrhea from just about any cause in adults, and from children, the only cause that seems to be exempt is rotavirus, you'll see a reduction of symptoms. And the suggestion is that you keep taking probiotics for a couple weeks later. If you're going to travel, you can reduce your risk of traveler's diarrhea by, well, quite a bit, 15%, if you start taking probiotics 2 days before travel and continue them throughout the trip. I'll also throw in, this is less scientific and more just clinical experience, but if a person is traveling with probiotics and they get traveler's diarrhea, taking about 200 billion, that's billion with a B, probiotics every 4 hours for a day will usually knock that diarrhea flat and get you back on the road enjoying your vacation. Children have anywhere from 20 to 25 fewer cases of diarrhea, and watery diarrhea is substantially reduced. And now let's talk about doctor-caused diarrhea. This is the diarrhea that we get when we take antibiotics. If you have not heard of Clostridium difficile, let me tell you about this very nasty bug that many of us carry in just a few seeds in our intestines. And that's fine, because this bug is a wimp. It doesn't grow well if there are other bacteria present. So the only time we're really vulnerable to it is when we take a broad-spectrum, high-dose antibiotic for a bacterial infection like, say, a pneumonia, and we wipe out all of those competing bacteria. Well, Clostridium difficile is the last bug standing, and stand up it does. And once it grows to high levels in your intestine, your rate of cure is about 70%. The first time, if you get a relapse, your rate of cure drops to about 50 to 40%. If you get another relapse, your chances of a cure are very, very slim, in the teens. And this bug is a bad one. It makes people very uncomfortable and causes real problems. If you take Lactobacillus rhamnosus or Saccharomyces boulardii at about 40 billion units per day, I advise this to take it when you're not putting antibiotics in your stomach. So if it's a 3 times a day antibiotic, find a space that you can take that 40 billion at least 2 hours before or after the antibiotic, and you will reduce your risk of this really terrible infection. Antibiotics also just cause diarrhea, not necessarily C. difficile, and you can have a substantial reduction in antibiotic-associated diarrhea. And there's studies that show that you can basically, if you treat 10 people, you'll prevent one case. Risk ratio for C. difficile, you've got 3 times more risk if you don't take probiotics. So you might ask yourself, why are probiotics not a standard part of medical therapy? And I asked that question myself recently, and I found that of the 2 local hospitals here in the Monterey Bay area that I contacted, one of them, Dignity Dominican, does not have probiotics on their formula. Watsonville Community, to their credit, does. And so I am personally going to declare war on this policy, and I have a contact out to the chief of the pharmacy there, and I would welcome any letters that anyone cares to write supporting the use of probiotics, because I think this is a consumer issue as well as a scientific one. There's plenty of data, but corporations also consider their corporate bottom line, and I think when you want to change an institution, the public has a great edge in just saying, hey, we want this. Now, until such time as it's available at your local hospital, what you should do is ask your doctor to write an order allowing you to use your own probiotics, and then go out and buy some Lactobacillus rhamnosus or a good mixture of probiotics, lots of Lactobacillus, lots of Bifidobacterium, maybe some Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a beneficial yeast, and bring in an unopened sealed package, and with your doctor's note, you'll be able to use it. You actually can bring in your own things, and in general, you won't get much push-up back if it's a sealed package. Therefore, it's got what it says it's got in it. Strongly recommend that anyone going into the hospital with an infection get themselves on probiotics if they're at all able to take oral. It's really important. Now, I mentioned ulcers and proton pump inhibitors earlier. H. pylori, which is a bacteria that causes ulcers, is also very difficult to eradicate, and lactobacillus-containing probiotics also increase the ability to eradicate H. pylori. So if you use standard therapy, you will get one level of eradication, but if you use the probiotics in addition, you're going to reduce your odds ratio, improve your eradication by about 50%, up to 1.44 odds of success. That's a substantial improvement, and obviously good reason. People with liver disease, particularly end-stage liver disease, develop something called hepatic encephalopathy. This is a type of delirium that's caused by bacteria in the gut, basically causing substances that the liver has disposed of to be recirculated into the bloodstream. In other words, the liver is weak and it's barely managing to detoxify the chemicals that are coming in through food and the environment. And the bacteria impair that detoxification substantially. Probiotics reduce the chance of developing the hepatic encephalopathy. There are several controlled trials that establish this, so this is another reason why it should be available on the hospital formulary. Anytime someone who's got alcoholism has a GI bleed and they start to have blood that's being digested, they will often decompensate and go into this hepatic encephalopathy. And it makes management of the GI bleed and the patient very difficult because they go crazy. And you have a hard time controlling them without giving them more drugs, which their liver's not able to handle. So it's a vicious circle. Probiotics also are effective in increasing remissions rates in adults with ulcerative colitis and allowing them to retain their remission. You only have to treat 8 people. This thing about treating people, this is called the number needed to treat. This is really an important way to look at the practical aspects of science. Because, for example, everybody knows that statins prevent heart attacks, right? Well, if you're a high-risk 50-year-old male who's never had a heart attack but has a high cholesterol, maybe in smokes and has high blood pressure, any doctor would say, yeah, we got to put you on a statin to prevent a heart attack. Well, we know in that group, you have to treat 50 of such guys 10 years to prevent one heart attack. And we still consider that a completely legitimate reason to pay for statins and to order them, because one heart attack prevented that's a good day spent. Irritable bowel syndrome also responds to probiotics. There's numerous studies that show improvement in the level of abdominal pain, the episodes of bloating, flatulence, and other symptoms of irritable bowel. And not only does it help diarrhea and bloating and farting, but it actually helps constipation. So you see, the probiotics just are good for what ails you, as my grandma used to say. And there's a significant increase in improvement in bowel function in people who take probiotics. Lactobacillus reuteri works for colic. And there's studies that show that you can reduce the duration of crying time down to below a week. And if anyone's ever taken care of a colicky infant, the idea that you're going to get 7 days off on your colic kid would be huge. And last but not least, in premature infants, there's a risk of the bacteria that get in to their intestines, which, of course, we can't keep them in a completely sterile environment, so they get things like skin bacteria. Well, those skin bacteria can take over, and they can start to digest the intestine. This is called necrotizing enterocolitis, and it's often enough lethal in very young newborn infants. Well, the use of probiotics in these infants significantly reduced the risk of severe enterocolitis, and we're talking about something that's life-threatening, and it reduced the risk of death. So the relative risk of death was 65% compared to not treating. And yet, this is not standard of care in our local hospitals. And I just have to say, something's got to give here. The data is there, and the people, the lawyers at corporate, shouldn't be practicing medicine either. Our first caller, that's David. Hello, David. Have we got you?
Hi. How are you doing today?
Oh, just fine. How are you?
Good. Just based on my own personal experience, I'm a believer in the probiotics to the extent that they make my stomach work better and feel better. But I wanted to ask you if you can get sufficient probiotics from just food sources, and if you can, if there's anything better than the fermented vegetables and yogurt that I already consume.
Well, Let me answer that last question first, which is to say that sauerkraut, kimchi, and yogurt are the best fermented foods. There's also something called water kefir, or kefir, depending upon your desire to pronounce it in a cool fashion. And these have also high levels. Kombucha is another source. I personally find kombucha very difficult to take when it's made the way it's supposed to be made, which is to say the traditional way. There's a whole bunch of kombucha products out there because, God forbid, that somebody shouldn't take advantage of a marketing opportunity, right? And I don't know how good those are. The studies are all done on the actual fermented stuff, so I just don't know if that's as good.
Well, and a lot of those beverages have sweeteners in them, which seems to obviate the whole benefit of the probiotics.
Precisely, and so I would say that until we have data that says that they work, they probably shouldn't be considered a functional food. Another really important thing is prebiotics, and there's certain vegetables, Jerusalem artichokes, root vegetables, apples. These all provide substrate that encourages the growth of those probiotics that you're putting into your body. So non-digestible fiber is extremely important. And if you can't manage to eat enough vegetables, what one of my teachers recommended was a different root vegetable every day. You know, you could cook it and throw it in the smoothie. It doesn't matter whether you chew it or drink it, but the root vegetables are each a little bit different, and they each encourage a different set or suite of probiotic bacteria. And what we do see is that most American adults, because of antibiotic use over the years, have a impaired diversity in their microbiome. I mean, we're always talking about racial diversity, but this is basically species diversity, and it's important to have the broadest possible species diversity because each one has myriad things, properties that it does that are generally beneficial, and so you get more benefit if you're on a broad if you have a broad spectrum of prebiotics. So I believe that the very first question you asked was, can you get enough from food? And my answer there is, it depends on the circumstances. For if you're healthy and you are not getting antibiotic treatment and you don't have an infection, you don't need these mega doses of probiotics that I'm talking about. You don't need 200 billion organisms 3 or 4 times a day. You need that under special circumstances. If you're trying to prevent Clostridium difficile, and I would probably, under those circumstances, I'm generally using 50 to 100 billion mixed flora plus 500 milligrams of the S. boulardii, because I have patients with C. difficile and I see them suffering, and it's persistent suffering for some of them. And so I just want to do everything I can possibly do to prevent. You know, there's a saying, I'll translate it from the Spanish, but it's better to prevent than lament. And boy, is that ever true when it comes to probiotics and their benefits.
Okay, that makes sense.
Any follow-up question?
No, that was very informative. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for your show.
Bye-bye. So we are going to read an email. This was from Sandra in Chapel Hill. Sandra wrote, subject is Dale Bredesen. He has a new book out, The End of Alzheimer's. Will you review it and comment on it? The program he has outlined seems to be working for a number of patients. Thanks for your invaluable work. So back in June, we did a program on Dale Bredesen. I was very impressed with his work and his papers. The man has the real chops as a scientist, and he's been doing solid science for 20 years, looking at the mechanisms of Alzheimer's, exactly what's going on with this beta amyloid accumulation, and he has an elaborate hypothesis, which if you go to the archives at AskDrDon.com, you can find that program and listen to it, and I won't drop into it here because I want to talk to you, but the just for Sandra and everyone else, maybe with a family history of Alzheimer's who's concerned about themselves. He frames it as the death of 1,000 paper cuts. He says that there are multiple factors that are at work here leading to inflammation in the brain, and that the inflammation leads to the accumulation of a protein, beta amyloid, which does not dissolve. This is not the soluble beta amyloid. This is the non-soluble beta amyloid. And just like yesterday's newspapers, it accumulates in the hallways of our brains. Anyone who's ever seen the program Hoarders has seen people's houses where there's just unbelievable amounts of stuff that never leave the house. And eventually the house becomes clogged. Well, if you can't take out the garbage in your brain, like any other tissue, eventually the functioning of the brain is impaired. And that's how we think of Alzheimer's. But what's causing the trash to build up, and what can we do about it? And one of and there are about 32 things that he's identified that need to be rectified, and they range from the level of copper in your bloodstream to your blood sugar, and whether or not your blood sugar gets higher than it should at any point during the 24-hour day. Insulin resistance is one of the tickets to Alzheimer's, and we've known this for a long time. Your age that you get your Alzheimer's is easily 10 or 15 years younger if you have diabetes and it's not well controlled. And we think that that may have something to do with the fact that insulin and beta amyloid interact very closely in the brain. And if you are dealing with a lot of insulin, you tend not to deal with your beta amyloid, in other words, not take out that trash. Other items in the book refer to being in ketosis, which is a type of metabolic state where you're burning fat instead of burning sugar or glucose. And this particular state is induced, among other things, by fasting. And you'll often hear about the ketogenic diet if you're reading in alternative medicine circles. And this is another area that's extremely important. The right probiotics and the right gut flora also seem to make a big difference in the development of Alzheimer's, as well as a host of other diseases that maybe we'll have a chance to mention some of the more recent research during this program. We're going to go now to Mike in Santa Cruz. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
I was curious about what you thought about iridology. I read a book by that title by Dr. Bernard Jensen, and he talked about the influence of the gut on the body, and it made a lot of sense. And then recently I saw a YouTube video where a woman who admittedly had a really bad diet and didn't have bowel movements only once or twice a week, she went on a raw foods diet, and her eyes changed from brown to blue. So I was just curious what your take on iridology was.
Well, I think that it's a very interesting hypothesis, and the idea that the pigments in the eye could change that much, that one is, I'm kind of like from Missouri on it. I would want, just because basically, okay, contact lenses and internet fame, and so I'd like to see a series of studies done where people, you could easily take a picture of someone's iris and then change their diet and take another photo of their iris. And this could be, you know, done perhaps in a more controlled setting rather than just anecdotal. So what should happen in science is you should basically, it's like, oh, that's really interesting. Let's go out and recruit people that are going into a diet study and look and see if their irises change. Now, I've seen books on iridology that make claims that you can diagnose, you know, cancer of the colon and, you know, various diseases by, you know, location, by a spot in a certain location. And I have, I'm real skeptical about that one. But that being said, there are all of these reflex systems in medicine, Oriental medicine in particular. So Chinese acupuncture, Korean acupuncture, Japanese acupuncture. This is all about the fact that there would be a reflection on the surface of the body of what's going on the inside of the body. And if you could learn to read this reflection, then you would you might be able to diagnose, but also you might be able to treat. And I myself use auricular medicine, which is where there's a presumed upside down figure, kind of a curl. Think of a curled up baby in the womb. And the head would be on the earlobe, and the rest of the baby is kind of crammed up on the top of the ear. And I use that in my medical practice with good results by putting little pins in areas that correspond to the liver and the colon. And in fact, there's something called the Lincoln Protocol, or NADA, and this is used in so many our narcotic rehab programs, it's not even funny. So when people are going in for their court-mandated detox, they're getting ear points for 15, 20 minutes every day. And it's paid for because it works. And you can't argue with success. It also works for quitting smoking. And I've had lots of success using these points. So there's something to the idea. But you've got to, you know, before you can validate someone's before you can believe in someone's interpretation, you've got to validate it. In my book, you've got to validate it by people who, you know, it'd be easy. Somebody says he knows iridology, he can read diagnoses. You've got a bunch of people with and without colon cancer, take pictures of their irises, give it to him, see what his hit rate is. Can he, you know, that's an easy study to do. And I wish we did more studies like that. Back in the 70s, there were a lot of studies done on ESP and, you know, various other precognition. And there was more interest in trying to explore these things scientifically and not just, you know, saying, oh, it's all bunk. You know, I think there's gold in them. There are alternative hills myself, but there's also a lot of fool's gold. And that's what science does best, is it helps us separate the gold from the fool's gold.
Yep, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, and my compliments on a great show, and you're really good at explaining complicated things to the layman, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's my great pleasure to be able to do that here today, and thank you very much for the call. Back to the microbiome for a moment. Microbiome is now thought to be important in diabetes. There have been a number of really interesting rat studies. I love this particular, you know, where they take gut microbiota from obese mice and transplant them into germ-free lean mice and then give them the same number of calories a day and watch the obese bacteria mice that receive the transplant get fat. And the ones who didn't get that, who got bacteria from lean mice, stay thin. And the change was about 60% increase in body fat over 14 days. And all of the mice developed insulin resistance. So they all became pre-diabetic. And this works both ways. So here's a study where they took obese mice who'd undergone gastric bypass surgery. And the ones that had undergone gastric bypass surgery, their stool, once they lost weight and their stool changed, their microbiome shifted. And then when you transplanted from the bypass surgery mice who had been fat to fat mice, they lost weight. So it was as if you were doing the lean mouse stool transplant. And so clearly the gastric bypass surgery had a profound effect on the microbiome, which really shouldn't surprise anyone. What we see in the microbiome, by the way, are two important phyla of bacteria, Bacteroides and Firmicutes. And most of the bacteria fall into, well, about 90% are either one or the other. Firmicutes generate more energy. So, and they also like a high-fat diet. So if you have animals on a high-fat diet, they will develop more Firmicutes. Obese humans have more Firmicutes than thin humans, regardless of their reported diets. And so the question, it's a real chicken and the egg question, is the bacteria influencing what we choose to eat, is what we choose to eat influencing the bacteria? And I think the answer is yes, it's a feedback loop. So eating that raw diet, basically think of all the things that are fattening that you wouldn't want to eat raw. Raw wheat, for example, yeah, kind of forget it. Well, that's all the wheat. Raw corn, not so much. Raw meat, well, maybe some fish and steak tartar, but you're not going to eat lots of it. So when you go to a raw food, you eliminate a lot of things that would probably be favorable to the Firmicutes, and you probably get a lot of things. You get the bacterioides phyla that are associated with thinness. I think it's really interesting that diabetes is associated with high rates of Firmicutes to bacterioides, and you also see changes in the fatty acids that are produced. So less butyrate, more acetate, and it turns out acetate itself, which is produced by the bacteria in the gut, causes insulin resistance and increases ghrelin. That's a hormone that stimulates the appetite. So if you raise butyrate, which by the way is very prevalent in ghee, which is clarified butter, you can actually make a difference. So what would I suggest you do if you're trying to lose weight? Lots of vegetables. Absolutely use ghee as one of your oils so that you raise your butyrate. Take probiotics, particularly of the bacterioides phyla, which includes lactobacillus, and see if you can shift yourself in the direction. And if you're desperate and happen to have a close family member would be ideal, who's had a gastric bypass, well, maybe you can consider doing your do-it-yourself at-home fecal transplant. I'm really kidding there. I don't recommend at this time that people do their own fecal transplants. I believe that more research is needed, and the danger of giving yourself something adverse is high enough that I just don't think the risk-benefit it favors doing that, particularly for obesity when there are so many other dietary things that can be done. So let's go to our next caller, and that is Gloria. Hello, Gloria.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about, I heard a program regarding Alzheimer's and memory loss, and this person was saying that the antidote was a ketogenic diet, which I just heard you mention, and I wonder if you could extrapolate on that. What is the ketogenic diet? Is it indeed an antidote or even a prevention for memory loss?
Well, I believe that it is a beneficial therapy. In terms of prevention, Dr. Dale Bredesen thinks that it is preventative to be ketogenic light. He doesn't recommend being full-on ketogenic when you're in the prevention phase, but if you're starting to show signs of dementia, then the recommendations that he made in his recent book I reviewed would essentially put you into a moderate ketogenic diet. So things like fasting, and then when you do eat, eating essentially no grain and no sugar is the basic hallmark of the ketogenic diet. So, it depends. I mean, there are really, if you're trying to treat seizures in children who have intractable seizures, then that ketogenic diet basically means feeding them a ton of heavy cream and a few vegetables and a moderate amount of protein. And that's not a very palatable diet, but when you're dealing with a child, you have pretty good control, or you can't, if they've got intractable seizures, they're not in school, so you don't have to worry about lunch and recess torpedoing your diet. It's also being used in autism, and I'm not sure if its benefit is the ketogenic aspect of it or the fact that it shifts the bowel flora so drastically. We run the risk with humans of misattributing something. You know, it may work for a different reason. With respect to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, there's a lot of good data that people with, particularly Parkinson's, is easier because it's it's a movement disorder, so you can see whether there's an improvement. And if you go on a ketogenic diet, there tends to be a substantial improvement in the Parkinson's symptoms. So that's something you can really see, and it's quite persuasive. With respect to Alzheimer's, it's harder to test cognition. There's more things operative at any given moment, but indeed, ketogenic diets have reduced symptoms substantially. And I think in studies, the problem is they're going to be non-responders, and there's going to be people who aren't actually doing it right, and that kind of muddies the waters in the study. But in the Bredesen, and these are anecdotal, I mean, the problem with Alzheimer's is there's multiple causes. There's multiple things you have to do to get a real benefit. And so we can't do science on multiple things. We don't do science on multiple things. The whole principle of science is that you have only one or two variables, and everything else is held constant across the groups. And if you have to do 32 things, which is what Dale Bredesen may be recommending for some people, that is impossible to study. So all you can do is look at test people pre and post and say, wow, they got a lot better, and they went back to work, and their tests on all these cognitive things went back to the normal range for their age, and their hippocampus got bigger on MRI. I mean, I'm very persuaded that something's working when parts of the brain that were shrinking start growing again. I don't really need a placebo, because you don't see that. You don't see the hippocampus regrow. That's unheard of. And now suddenly we're seeing it. And there's the studies. You can put them up on the light blocks and look at the images. So I'm persuaded that it's beneficial. It's hard, but it's beneficial.
Okay, what about plaque? Is it the cause or not? Because now I'm hearing that it's processed foods. Of course, I believe that processed foods are guilty of a lot of, health problems. But what about plaque not being the cause of Alzheimer's?
Well, I'll tell you what that's based on, and that's based on the fact that you can do autopsies on 80-year-olds, and you can find people who were, actively on the internet, blogging, doing art, volunteering in their communities, completely functional people, doing the New York Times crossword puzzle every morning, and then they die and they will their brain to science, and somebody slices it up and it's full of plaques, and yet they don't have any sign of Alzheimer's. And there's, you don't need too many cases of that to throw water on the idea that it's simply the plaques. I think I see the plaques as think of it as smoke. You see billowing smoke. There's a fire, or maybe somebody's got a special effects machine and they're making a movie. But the odds favor fire. So there's more to it. There's more than just plaque at work here, and the single factor that seems to be that, according to Dale Bredesen, and I actually believe this. I think he makes a very good case for it. Is inflammation. Infection of any kind, particularly chronic infection. So we know that if you have recurrent oral herpes and you have Alzheimer's, you'll get a lot worse during a herpes outbreak. I mean, functionally, you will deteriorate. And we've found herpes virus in those plaques when we look for it. So somehow the virus is getting into the brain. That's not such a big surprise. It's triggering inflammation. That inflammation is compromising the already compromised synapses, and you get a decline in function. But his idea is that the inflammation actually drives the formation of the plaques. And when you're in an inflammatory state, certain enzymes break down this thing called amyloid precursor protein, which is sitting on the surface of the cell. And it's like a little pair of scissors that comes along and chops off a bit of that precursor protein, and it chops it off into the insoluble amyloid that accumulates. And when there's no inflammation, a different pair of scissors goes in and cuts it in a different place, and you make something called soluble amyloid, which doesn't form plaques. And so the inflammation is driving which pair of scissors is being generated by the DNA in the brain, and then those scissors are doing the deed that creates the amyloid. but then the plaque all by itself can, in some situations, not be associated with Alzheimer's. And that piece of the puzzle, I think the jury is still out on what's the X factor that protects people with all that plaque who don't develop Alzheimer's. And, you know, that's the question we'd all love to know, because then the family risk probably goes away. And that would be lovely. Part of the problem with the drugs, I'm just going to change topic for just a second.
Well, thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Part of the problem with the drugs is the drugs are all based on mouse work. And we have this Alzheimer's mouse, but the problem with the Alzheimer's mouse is that it makes lots of extra amyloid, so it develops lots of extra amyloid plaques. But that's not what happens in humans. Humans don't make lots of extra amyloid all their lives. They make amyloid only in the presence of inflammation, and the type and the tendency towards the inflammatory response. And this is funny, because if you get a 23andMe, they'll tell you that your ApoE genome increases your risk of Alzheimer's. So if you have an ApoE2, you're the lowest risk. If you have ApoE3, it's intermediate. If you've got two copies of ApoE4, your risk of Alzheimer's is much, much higher than the general population. And ApoE4 has nothing to do with amyloid. But what ApoE4 does have is people who have ApoE4 are better at fighting infections. They have, and hear it here, they have a more robust inflammatory response. So they are the people who rarely get sick. And in fact, I've treated lots of Alzheimer's patients, and I don't know what most of their genetics were, but there's a whole subset of really healthy older Alzheimer's people, and it's always kind of struck me as ironic that some of the healthiest elders are the ones whose brains are the least healthy. And I think this idea that ApoE4 is protecting their body, but in fact damaging their brain, makes sense. So when you have something that explains the observable phenomenon, that doesn't mean for sure it's true, but you give it a couple of extra credibility points, right?
Wow, I wish I would have taped this. You've given me so much information. Okay, well, thank you very, very much.
And thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're coming to right up to the end of the hour, so not a lot of time for anything else, but I wanted to give you a quick little hint on hantavirus, which is a virus that comes in mouse droppings. We've had a couple of cases in California recently, a substantial one. So if you go into cabins, trailers, or other buildings that have been infested with rodents, please wear a mask. This virus gets into your bloodstream, and then it gets into your lungs, and then it gets into your bloodstream, and it can cause very severe lung disease.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.